Session number 4989, reel 2.
Ian Struthers, reel 2. What did you do upon arriving in Algiers?
Well, get on a motorcycle, strangely enough. It had been announced that on the convoy ship that they had a whole lot of motorcycles and no drivers, so I sort of vaguely said, well, if you want someone to drive a motorcycle, I'll drive a motorcycle for you. And they took me up on this. So the first thing I did was to drive from the docks up to this hotel, which was the billet for Army public relations, war correspondents and conducting officers and administrative officers and so on. And having got there on the motorcycle, they said, do you mind going back and getting another one? So I went back and got another one for them. Finally, I suppose they got enough drivers for these motorcycles. But that was my introduction to a war zone and being very green on war procedures, army procedures. I just had an odd home guard experience, which was hardly the same thing.
And who did you report to in the PR?
The man who looked after us was Major Flood, a regular officer who had got the whole thing sorted out vis-a-vis the likes of myself. He'd done the same job in France before it all fell, and he knew what was wanted and what ticked vis-a-vis us. He had a sidekick, Warrant Officer Billet, who also knew what it was all about, which was very fortunate, because many of the public relations officers were not newspaper, newsreel, still photographer types, which was a great shame.
What type were they?
Well, they varied. Some were absolutely marvellous in that particular job, but as you probably know, when the army is asked for volunteers, to suggest volunteers for a particular thing, they always volunteer something they want to get rid of. And when PR said we need so many officers and it was sent round to various units, they always got rid of the riffraff on us. And I think this went both ways. And one or two were from the newspaper industry in one form or another. And but the majority weren't. They were from various walks of life. Mind you, this was necessary because they wanted people who could see to the catering and see to the signals and administration and that sort of thing. But we were concerned with what is known as the conducting officer, who was meant to know what we wanted and to get us to the place that we should be at the right time. This was a problem.
Can you recall any particular incident?
Well, one of the first things Flood explained to me was, of course, that the higher level didn't want newsreel and newspaper photographers because they said they could get it all from the Army Film and Photographic. Well, this, up to a point, was, of course, perfectly true because the Army Film and Photographic had professional people in it. More so on the still side. Very little, not at all on newsreel side, but quite a bit on film side. Very similar, but not quite the same thing. And Army Film Photographic was there to record what the Army did in the war, whereas a newsreel cameraman was there to take pictures for the public to see what the Army was doing at that time. Sometimes they overlapped these things, and sometimes they were quite different. There was Colonel McCormack, a marvellous Irishman, who was somewhat anti-me, I don't think personally, but the fact that I was there. The newsreels had insisted on having people there with the army. And I was sort of, in a mild way, the butt of some of the problems. However, I just soldiered on, as they say, in two ways.
Were you the only newsreel cameraman attached to the headquarters in Algiers?
Yes. I was the only newsreel cameraman, 2nd Army, North Africa. There were two French newsreel cameramen, professional newsreel cameramen with the French forces, and I think two or three with the Americans, because they always rather overdid these things as compared with ourselves.
Did you work more together with those other correspondents or more together with the Army Film Unit?
Oh, more with the Army Film Unit, because the American correspondent covered the American corps and the Frenchman covered their corps. It was the two major brothers. And I was there to cover the British Army, First Army, as they called it.
What were your relations like with the AFPU itself?
Oh, excellent. The thing was, they were friends of mine. Long-standing friend Harry Rignold, alas, who was killed as a result of the Salerno landing, and he died in Bone, I believe, in the hospital in Bone, or brought back. He and I had been the two assistant cameramen at GBI, so I'd known him for a long time. And then Glendinning, they're both captains, Glendinning had been one of the cameramen when I first started at Sound City, so I knew him from many years standing.
Are you aware why Harry Rignold was chosen to be the first War Office cinematographer in September 1939? Did he ever mention why he had been selected?
No, I don't know why. I imagine he was called up. But I don't know that. I can't remember whether he ever told me. I don't know. He was in right at the beginning. I should say that was rather luck that he ever got onto that job. I mean, it's a square peg in a square hole, in a marvellous way, and it didn't always happen. It did in this case. If I go back a little in history, when I was at MOI, I had three interviews, one with each of the services, with a view to being called up in them. And I was interviewed by an incredible man called Colonel Clay. I had a marvellous army medical. I was very impressed with that. And then he asked me various questions. And he was a regular officer, and I believe quite a well-known character. But he had no idea how to interview the likes of myself. And he was very rude to me, because he was a little worried that I might have relations who were high up in the military. This came out very obviously, and he didn't like to suggest or say the wrong thing. And when I said that my father had been killed when in the London Scottish, he said, "Oh, I don't mean anything like that. Do you have relations?" I said, "What do you mean, don't mean anything like that?" He said, "Oh, that's territorial." I said, "You'll apologize for that." And he did. And I said, "Well, I do happen to have a cousin who is in intelligence in the War Office." And he said, "Well, who is he?" I said, "That is one thing I don't tell you or anybody." And he was a little taken aback. And I asked in a letter to have another interview with somebody competent to interview me, as I had suggested that if I was called up, I should go into the Army Film and Photographic. He said, "Oh, I don't know anything about that. That's not a unit at all. I've never heard of that." And went on fluffling away. He said, I expect we'll put you in some signals outfit or something like that." And I wrote to the ministry of whatever it was that dealt with all these things and said, "Could I have another interview?" And the man was obviously very worried by this letter, and he phoned me back the next morning when he got it, and he said, "Do you really want this?" I said, "Not in the least," but I was determined to put something on paper about this idiot. He said, "I don't tell me about that man." He said, "I'm full of complaints about him." He said, "Would it be enough to say that your letter goes on the file?" I said, "Yes." And that letter was produced for me when I went for the RAF interview about 3 months later. The man knew my views. But they couldn't call me up because I was with MOI for some reason or other, although it was not technically a reserved occupation. However, I digressed there. Your question was?
My next question is, what were the advantages of working closely with the Army Film Unit, apart from the benefit of personal friendships?
Because through Hugh Stewart, who ran that unit, they had the nearest equivalent to a news desk. And Hugh, with his contacts with both intelligence and operations at the various corps always knew in advance what was going to happen where, which was the only way he could assign his sergeants and a few officers, mainly they were the photographers were sergeants, to the right group, the right place, the right time. And Hugh gave me more information than anyone else on suitable stories from my point of view. And sometimes he even suggested that I did a story thinking that the Army Film Unit and their usage might benefit from it, but it might not be 100% in his interest to put his men on it.
Can you think of an example?
Oh, dear. I can't offhand, no. This is going back too long in history. If I had all the dope sheets, maybe I might suggest one. The other source of information, of course, was either Harry or Harry Rignold or Honey Glendinning, who also knew because they were running the office under Hugh Stewart. They knew that. And they both went out doing a certain amount of photography because they're both cameramen, of course. And so it was through them that I got more information. The PR for the newspaper and agency writers was always far too far back because they wanted to get things at corps level, and they got all their information on reports coming back to corps level. I was interested in knowing what frontline units were doing. There were exceptions, of course. Things happened behind that were worthy stories worth covering. So, apart from wanting to be many miles ahead of press camp most of the time, I got more of my information, so say, through them at that time. I used to go with some of the correspondents to the various corps to get information. The public relations officers, I believe, were meant to be able to supply this, but no way did they ever do it, because they were not news people. This was the thing. They were mainly, the higher level of them, they were regular officers, and had no experience whatsoever. One or two of them headed in France, but one in particular had been in France. We'd really learned nothing about our side and our problems, which is a great shame. It made life, from that point of view, rather difficult.
You have described the difficulties of gathering information about what news to film. What help did you have with transport from the Army Film Unit?
Well, in the early days, through finding some vehicles in the harbour at Algiers, when the whole public relations was terribly short of vehicles before the main bulk of them came in, and I had the use of one of those for a time and shared it with one or other of the writers, because not always, nor often, could the writers want to go to the same place as I did, because we wanted different types of stories, and they would want to be there for 10 minutes and I'd want to be there for 2 hours. So I hindered them and they hindered me. I did go out, and I did have at that time a driver assigned to me with a PU, which I could use on my own when they got a few more vehicles. And at times I went out with one of Hugh's sergeant photographers, usually a still photographer, so that it wasn't a doubling up. It was no good my going out with one of his movie photographers, because he would get probably much the same pictures. Although you can walk 100 yards away and the whole countryside looks different, and you either do or don't get what's happening. So it was a bit mixed how I got myself around. I didn't own a vehicle like one or two of the writers bought their own vehicles. There was always a hassle on that, was it getting petrol and camouflage and so on, and being illegal. We weren't meant to drive army vehicles, but we did, of course, for our own benefit, but to relieve the drivers sometimes, because there were quite long drives, and they didn't mind.
How far forward did you consider you should go to film frontline action? As far forward as the Army Film Unit, or did you think that they, with their military training, should be further forward than yourself?
I don't think that thought ever came into my mind. I don't think the Army Film Photographic boys were very much more militarily trained than I was. They did go through, yes, the square-bashing nonsense, yes. But I don't think this gave them any great knowledge of filming war at all. They either had it or didn't have it, I think you might say. And
but they could be told to go somewhere to film something.
Oh, yes, they were assigned to anything from a corps to a company.
Whereas it was entirely up to yourself, as I understand it, to choose what
yes,
you wished
to
do.
Yes, I chose what I did. And I therefore was never with any one outfit for any length of time. I tried to do, ring the changes, and to go with those that were doing something. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. This is the point. I probably saw more action, heard more action, certainly, than many of the Army Film Photographic boys, because they may have been assigned to a unit which didn't actually go in or went in, came out quicker. Whereas I was on my own, tended to go in more. But not that that means I got more better stuff, probably not. It's very difficult to get action stuff on the ground. You can be just the wrong side of the hedge and not know that marvellous pictures are going on the other side of the hedge.
Were you handicapped by your equipment? What cameras did you have?
In North Africa, I had the Newman Sinclair. I think I only had that one there, did I? Or did I have the De Vrij? No, I had that later. The Newman Sinclair, 200-foot clockwork model. The standard pre-war Model A. I suppose weighed 25, 28 pounds with one lens on. And magazines were 200-foot, and they were difficult to carry. I used to put one in a haversack pack. The correction there is I did have the De Vrij on that at that period, which was the 100-foot spool, which was very much easier to cope with. And it had three lenses, which was limiting. But then I worked without a tripod, so one didn't expect to use long lenses, telephoto or anything like that. And I could walk further with the De Vrij. It only weighed 5 or 8 pounds, I suppose. And I used to take rolls of film in their tins, which in themselves were about 4 inches diameter, 35 mil, inch and, well, with a tin about an inch and a half thick. I used to put 3 or 4 of these inside my battle dress blouse to have freedom of for walking. And the camera I had on a piece of rope spliced to the two eyes over my shoulder, and I had the winder handle on another piece of rope dangling from my belt. So it was always at my right hand when I wanted to wind up, because you had to wind up between each scene pretty well. De Vrij took 100 foot, which is just over a minute's worth of film, and did, I think, about 12 or 15 seconds on a scene.
What did you use the Newman for? Because this was a very heavy camera.
I used that when I didn't have to walk so far. I wanted longer runs, more for static stuff. And I did have a long lens for that. The longest I had was a 12-inch, and did use that in frontline positions at times on the tripod, provided I could get, so to speak, dug down, just the camera showing over the top. Sometimes at OPs, at gunner OPs and things you could get to. This happened a number of times, because I could then use the long lens. But for sort of the background stories in Paris, Brussels, and all those places, it was better to use the Newman.
Could you say something about the censorship problems which you encountered, both from being advised what not to film and also finding that your film did not reach your company?
Yes. Well, I didn't know, to begin with, that the censored stuff was never even seen by the company, which is, of course, the right way to do it. You're going to censor it, you cut it out at the censors. I realized that there was little point in my wasting film and risking my life taking things that I knew could never be shown on the screen. This, of course, didn't apply to Army Film Photographic. They deliberately were assigned to take things that would never get through censorship because they were there to record a film for the Army. That is one of the other differences, of course. I tended to avoid certain things, and again, Hugh Stewart was the man who had the best knowledge for me on this sort of subject, because he was able to know immediately when certain bits of equipment, guns or tanks or whatever, were released. And usually the procedure, as far as I remember, which was really crazy, it wasn't when we knew that the enemy had captured it, but that we captured it back. This I never understood, but this was what I was told. And Hugh sometimes told me, he said, by the way, you know so-and-so is now released. He'd volunteer that, because it was in his interest that I got pictures, the right thing that was shown to the public. And we're all on the same side. pictures of German equipment, of course, well, that's fair enough. But I can tell you a lovely story. This is later on in the war. I was going to Walcheren, and a gunner came up to me and said, by the way, this gun is on the secret list. So I said, oh, heavens, I've already taken a few pictures of it. He said, well, you mustn't. I said, don't worry yourself. It goes through censorship. I will put on my dope sheet that this gun is understood to be on the secret list. He said, that covers me, which is quite right. He said, but that one over there, we captured from the Germans, which we're using against them. They were two small guns, taking something like 40mm shells. So he said, take a picture of that with the boys. They're doing quite well with it, so I did. And when I wrote my dope sheet out for the censor, I made a note that the such-and-such a gun with this outfit was said still to be on the secret list. Probably will have to be cut out. Warning. The other one is captured German. Later on, I saw that reel. The censor got the two guns muddled. Whether the Germans ever learnt anything, I don't know.
There was also an occasion in Sicily when you sent back a lot of film which didn't reach your company.
Oh, yes. I went on the assault craft, the LCIs, the bigger personnel landing craft, I think it had the two ramps down at the front, and we waded ashore, water up to our waists. You may remember in history, we were several hours, everything was several hours late because there was a phenomenal storm. And we were all incredibly seasick. Prior to all this, we'd been living with the outfit, infantry outfit, that we were invading with. I say we because there was one of the newspaper people and a conducting officer. How we got separated on the actual touching down ashore, they were in different LCIs. But we were all living together. It was the Highland Division. And the colonel greeted us when we arrived in this encampment in North Africa, in Tunisia, not far from Tunis, and said, Oh, worse the effect. You're all improperly dressed. We'll get Highland Division's flashes sewn on all your shirts forthwith. See to this happening to, you know, so all our shirts were whipped off and came back with Highland Divisional flashes on. And he said, we like to have these up because the Germans are rather frightened of the Highland Division. It makes it easier for us. They run quicker, and worse that effect, you see. So I thought, well, this is not a bad idea. And so ashore we went, and not 1 foot of that went through censorship. And Cummins wondered where I was. He didn't know that I was filming my heart out, and not one frame of it was, the whole thing was blocked, cut. So I gathered afterwards. And I believe quite a number of the stories later on in Sicily were cut because the Highland Division flashes were seen. You can't avoid it when you have one on each arm. So there you are. I don't know what future wars, they're going to have the same problem. But I'm sure the Germans knew. No way at all. Because there was another interesting thing from a security. When we went to Sicily, went from Sicily into Italy, we were asked not to say too forcibly where we'd come from to the local populations. The local population had absolutely no difficulty in telling which troops had come through Sicily and which troops had come from North Africa or maybe England or America, because they were all mixed up. Because they recognized the Sicilian-Italian accent that we'd picked up in our few words of Italian. We wanted to buy eggs and things. They knew immediately. So the whole thing was lost. Maybe you've heard that one before.
No, I haven't. Were you also hindered by high-up officers on any occasion from performing your task properly?
No. Never by high-up officers. The sort of brigadier level you're referring to there, no doubt.
I was thinking of General Robertson, who...
Ah, well, now, he was the exception. He didn't actually obstruct or hinder, but he was not exactly helpful or polite, yes.
Could you recall the incident?
Yes. He didn't endear himself to the army. This was very obvious, because he was never seen by them. He never appeared. And the nearest he got was in the Medjez Valley to present MCs and MMs and such like to quite a number of troops and officers and so on. And he came up forward for this. And he'd had his headquarters, I think, somewhere in Constantine, a couple of hundred miles behind, which was not the way to do it, as far as other people were concerned. He obviously thought it was. And he came and presented these medals. And afterwards he asked to meet the press. And we went into this farm, into this room, and I suppose there were about a dozen of us. This is the myself on the one side, and the newspaper and agency writers, and one or two conducting officers, and censor officer. Now, we didn't have a censor officer on the spot, because all our staff, particularly my photographs, and I gather all the writers' material, was censored when it got to London. I think I'm right in saying that. And the general didn't know this. And he started off by saying, I've had a questionnaire from one of you. I'm going to answer the questions. Well, anyway, some of them my way, or was that effect. And all these writers looked round at each other and didn't know what this was about. And he said, I've had this is question, answer this is this, and answer that is the other, and so on. He went through this list. Well, I happen to know what this list was, because Alan Humphreys of Reuters had shown it me when he was writing it, because we were living the farm together. And he submitted quite a number of his stories to me. He said, well, how does this sound? Because I was completely neutral. He couldn't submit it to the other writers, and the other writers wouldn't submit their stories to him, quite naturally. And several of the writers at times said, what do you think of this? And I would make comments, and they I think they must have valued some of the comments I made, particularly if it's things that I'd been at or seen, you know. And I made suggestions to any of them. We'll help each other. They often suggested stories to me, of course. And at the end, he said, is there any trouble from any of you? I'll have you sent out of this theatre of operations. You've got to adhere to all the rules and regulations. And these writers, we all looked at each other and wondered what had happened, you see. And then he said, I'm not to be quoted on any of this. Is there a censor here? And an officer stood up. He said, sir, I'm the censor. He said, are you? You look very young for the job. There was a deathly hush in this thing. Then he went out and we all trooped out. And they all said, who sent this questionnaire to the general? So I said to them, I said, Alan did. Alan wasn't there because only about 3 days earlier I'd put him in the back of the vehicle and driven him off to hospital with fever. So he couldn't be there to answer for himself. And as far as I remember, the newspaper boys said, right,